Osiris.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
This is Taj Mahal, and I am in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it has been the privilege of being able to please my ancestors to play music. It was a gift to me from the Creator. I just wanted to share what I feel with the world.
Well, for those of us who've been listening to you pretty much since birth, like me, my dad, and I grew up in Chicago, he was playing your 1968 self-titled on vinyl, probably from when I was in short pants, and I've rediscovered a lot of this music, this album that's coming out, a live record. Really, really impressed by sort of the energy in that room in Tulsa that you were able to create. Do you feel like when you bring back songs that you've been playing your whole life, it's like you're rediscovering lost treasure in a way?
I've been able to, you know, show people the gloriousness of this music and the fact that it is for everybody. But here's where it comes from, you know.
Honey in your honey pot. On your pot, your body's hot. In the honey pot. On the pot is what you got to rock under love of me. Made for my soul. Made for my soul. Rock me. Rock me to my soul. Rock me to my soul.
All right, we're back, and you're tuned in once again to the show on the road. I am your audio collector, Z Lupitin, and this week, to start, yes, season six, we are talking to Henry St. Clair Fredericks Jr., or as you might have already heard, Mr. Taj Mahal. If you're brand new here, welcome. I've had the privilege to talk to over 150 songwriters, band leaders, people who have made music that has changed my life and hopefully will change yours. Some of my earliest musical memories were sitting down and listening to these blues records that inspired the rock and roll gods that we all know and love today. The Allman Brothers, the Rolling Stones, those guys were listening to Muddy Waters and Taj Mahal and Robert Johnson, and my dad knew that I had to go to the source. Being able to talk to Taj Mahal and having him honestly give a masterclass on the history of music, one of the true privileges of my life as a songwriter and touring musician. And I'm so glad that you're here on the show on the road with me. Season six, let's kick it off in style. If you like what I do here, please leave a kind review on the podcast page and share it with your friends. That's it. Here's Taj Mahal. Well, when people think about Taj Mahal, you know, often your music is sort of reduced to like, well, he's a blues man, right? This is what, you know, people assume that, well, you're going to be playing stuff like Statesboro Blues, which is honestly one of my favorite songs of all time. The Allman Brothers took it.
There have been no way for nobody to know about Statesboro Blues. It would have gone on by That song, if you heard the original one, has nothing to do except the lyrics with the way that it began to be done. And Jesse Davis's idea to create a slide guitar on it, you know, his style of slide guitar in standard tuning rather than open tuning, you know, which is something that he got clearly from Muddy Waters. Right. And but he made it his own. And then, of course, Dwayne got in there and made it his own. And so, again, just like anything else, most people think that Statesboro Blues, you know, the rock, you know, crowd, you know, thinks that Statesboro Blues is the Allman Brothers song, which is fine by me, because it is that eventually they're going to wake up and realize that not only did it was it the Allman Brothers, but it was Jesse Davis, Taj Mahal, and the original artist, who was Blind Willie McTell on the 12-string guitar.
Your father, you know, definitely brought some of that Afro-Caribbean music into your life. He was a jazz arranger. A lot of folks sort of knew him. Your mother was, you know, in gospel choirs.
I mean, what the thing is that this was before the record industry,
right?
The music industry got to be the control and control the direction of what was happening with the music. Basically, right. You had the wild music over here developing all by itself and, you know, evolving and doing all those kinds of things. And then you had this group of, you know, industrialists or musical businessmen trying to find the thing that looked like it would be have the most commercial potential for the largest audience. Okay.
Right.
And then they would take those things out of this wild, you know, bunch of music over here and bring it over here and find an artist that they thought was, you know, significant to be able to work with this. And then the control over the financial, the fiduciary side of the business was in their hands over here. That wasn't the situation. Plus, and with that kind of idea, one thing that they don't understand, which is one of the things that you have to know about with farming, is that you have to put back into the soil what you take out. And oftentimes, the Western idea is to drive the soil until it's no longer, you know, useful, and then go somewhere else and do something more. They don't understand the cycle of moving things back into the soil. So oftentimes, an artist, music, you might have two or three songs that you have from that artist. But if you went back in, maybe 15 other songs, but because the businessman didn't have the idea of what it didn't have any commercial value to them, they basically threw the baby out with the bathwater or left those songs in the studio. And they should have rightly gone back to the culture that they came from. You know, this is like, it's like the way it's happening with museums now, where they're being asked to return artifacts that they took from people's lives. And this is the way music is too, you know.
You are one of the first people to expand that genre into world music.
You know, the information and music and creative side of it had been brewing since, you know, Africans were brought into the Western world and brought with them some of the instruments that we have and continue to have and continue to be in with, you know, the 11th century empire, Songhai Empire of Sundiata Keita, which covered Mauritania, Senegal, Gambia, Guinea, Guinea-Conakry, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, and many of the people that were brought to the West, you know, the so-called New World, were from these areas and brought with them many different things, which, you know, for the most part, people don't really know about, but the tradition is still going on. That's why I'm on the road presently with Sona Jabarte, who is the first woman to come into the tradition since the 11th century. There have been others, but she's the first one that is fully carrying the tradition. And so, yeah, I mean, it's for me, it was as a youngster in the 40s, I started, you know, my parents gave me a very good, you know, a foundation, you know, and self-awareness and confidence that I had a culture that was beyond just what's here in America. So right. I went looking for the connections between that, and the finger picking style of guitar is one of and the banjo and certain kinds of things that are put together are, you know, remnants of what people remember here, you know, but still that tradition is going on strong today and being passed.
It's like a game of telephone across, you know, racial barriers, across generations of people. And I think that people who have, you know, grown up with your music, heard their, you know, their parents play your music, and now have the new generation discovering your music, can kind of see a unique cross-section of basically the entire tapestry of human sound making, right? You bring in reggae music, you bring in Hawaiian music, which was pretty probably ahead of its time, especially in the 60s and 70s. When did you first discover, you know, sort of bringing in these more maybe tropical rhythms, or, you know, was that from your father, or did you always sort of want to bring that into the blues?
The culture I grew up in was basically, you know, a Creole culture, you know what I mean? In that, you know, we had a part of our family that was from the Caribbean. We had part of our family was the South. We lived in the Northeast, where a tremendous amount of people of all ethnic groups that lived together in the town that we're in, which was at that time, you know, going off with three different ships for factories and teaching. People had a lot of stuff going on. That's a rabbit hole we could talk all day on. But anyway, the thing of it was, is that culturally around me were all these things happening. And we also had an American International College in town. So by the time I was 10 years old, I had been spending time with Africans who came to that school, the American International College, and Caribbean people from all the Caribbean islands and from Latin American people. And so I thought of my culture as being very full, but I began to recognize that a lot of people didn't really know much about it. And oftentimes they heard, you know, styles of music through the popular mode. You know, you might have been lucky enough to hear Xavier Cugat or Javier Cugat, through play cha cha cha, you know, and it would be over here. But then you might have heard Everybody Like Wants a Cha 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 by Sam Cooke. You know, I remember all these different dances we did: merengue, cha cha, mambo, you know, all those kind of
passing
things.
Fads.
So it was always. It was always like that. But then as the industry got more and more controlled, less and less and less of that kind of music was to be found, you know, because a lot of times the people trying to sell the music didn't really know what was going on. But once they saw something that was popular, then they tried to, you know, hush up the competition as the best they could. And so consequently, the people, you know, they only get a narrow slice of what the music is. And I just was like, this guy out here said, hey, I don't know if you ever get out of here, but here's what else is out here. See, you were asking about mixing all this stuff. My first hearing of Hawaiian music came from my father's old radio record player back that had presets on like Tokyo, you know, Sydney, London, you know, and then Honolulu, you know, and happened to punch it in one day and just be totally overwhelmed and overcome down to the molecular structure of this music. That was incredible. And went in search for that particular sound. And it took me years to finally find exactly what it was and exactly who was playing it. And then now I work with musicians who have done the same with their cultures, followed through and kept, you know, some of these great things happening in modern times, you know.
Well, I think what's great about this new record, Swingin' Live at the Church in Tulsa, is it captures you, I think, in your element, you know, really having a conversation musically with the audience, bringing them into the music from the very beginning, right? You're asking them to sort of participate almost like it's a church service, right? Like they're going back and forth with you. And I can see you referencing certain things, you know, that opening track, Betty and Dupree. I can hear like a little bit of Hendrix's like version of Red House in there. You know, I can hear like sort of you're weaving in and out of the decades of music in one song.
Oh, let me, I'm gonna tell you a story about, tell you a story about Betty and Dupree.
What I try to say is that we're all here because we know why we're here.
Right.
It's just a family meeting, you know, that we're here because we know this, you know, but oftentimes, you know, the contemporary audience doesn't really know how to give to make that happen, and that they're more visual oriented. So they came not only to hear the music, but to see the music. And they don't put seeing and hearing together. That's one thing. So, you know, it takes a little time to introduce them to, you know, a part of their own being and spirit that they probably never knew they had going, and get in a room full of people who are vibing like that, and the spirit lifts off in the room. You know, then we're instead of the music on the stage and people in the audience, it's just we're one communicating with each other.
Do you think the music has kept you young in a way? I mean, most people are not touring full time into their 80s, right? I mean, you have a lot of energy that probably even us young musicians don't have. I saw you at a festival that my band, Dust Bowl Revival, played with you at Rhythm and Roots in Rhode Island, I believe, last year.
Wow.
And, you know, when you get on the stage, people see a guy who's been playing since the early 60s. You never know what you're going to get, and the fire that's still in you is so palpable. Where do you draw that energy from when you get up on stage?
Well, it's there all the time, man. It's just what I've decided, and I took a shot for about 10 years. I'd say from about 1961 to about 62, from probably like 67 to 77, I really put my energy into to basically trying to create something that was going to, quote, make it, unquote. I mean, because I was a little bit, I felt some way about it, that here, you know, we're a bunch of guys from 3,000 miles away or 6,000 miles away from when I was in California, meaning the British invasion. Here right. I was with Bry Cooter, Jesse Lee Kincaid, Gary Marker, either Kevin Kelly or Ed Cassidy, who became right. the drummer for Spirit. Here we were, an American group, you know, synthesizing the American sound and right. putting it out there. And we were getting no love from the industry.
Right.
I mean, they just completely turned away from us. And it was like, wait a minute, you know, you're supposed to take care of home first, you know? And so, I mean, that whole aggregation ended up, you know, the band broke up over not over anything that was happening with the music, but mostly happening with the music business, you know, right. but we all remained friends. And that's why Ry Cooter is he's a plays rhythm guitar on the first album. A lot of people thought it was Ry that was playing slide, because by the time they started really figuring out what was going on with my music, he had gone off and started his career, you know, as a studio musician playing right. slide on a lot of stuff. But, you know, I mean, the reason we did all this was, you know, to make people aware, you know, of the fact that, hey, man, you got a homegrown band here. I kept going on saying, well, if they don't understand it, I'm not going to stop because they don't get it. Because it's really important for me to be doing this. You know, if I was farming, I would still be looking for the different kinds of things I was looking for in music, you know, because, I mean, it's just important for me to be able to pick up an instrument and play some music. I don't have to plug into the wall. You know, right. the acoustic space around me is a sacred, you know, space to, create in. And, you know, I mean, it's just, I like to hear the music played, and that, you know, you get an audience, and everybody doesn't know what I'm doing, or if some do and some don't, you can't guarantee on that. What I know I got to do is that when I come to play the music, this is the time that I get to play. This is the thing that I'm doing. That's it. You get that, and then it's the next day. It's when you play again. You know, I mean, it's like, all you get is the day that you're in, man. It's like, there's no, there are no laurels to sit back on and say, well, I can just get up here and do a little something. I don't like that. That doesn't work for me. I like to, whatever it is, acoustically, solo, you know, full-size band, orchestra, anything. It's about the drive and the music. You know, there's a reason to be playing it, you know.
Well, I think that you have written songs that maybe don't get appreciated as having sort of the pop hook appeal that they should. You know, you have songs that you brought back, like Mailbox Blues, right, on this new record. I'm moving to the country, I'm going to paint my mailbox blue, right? Every time I'm driving out into, you know, the farm areas, you know, out of the big city, I always think of that song.
Yeah.
It's like, it's such a great line. It's like it encapsulates this entire escape mode that a lot of us people who lived in cities our life. You know what? I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to paint my mailbox blue. I don't even know what that means, and yet it works.
Yeah. I'm going to move up to the country, baby. Paint my mailbox blue. I'm going to move up to the country, baby. Paint my mailbox blue. Well, I mean, I had already done that by the time I actually wrote the song. I mean, And I was by the time I was 14, I was out picking tobacco for a couple of years. But that the biggest thing of going out into the country was basically my mom, because she was from South Carolina and was a farm girl, and but college girl, educated in early childhood development, and became a school teacher for like 40 years, amongst the other things that she did.
Right.
You know, five kids, six kids, and, you know, family, and deal with tragedy and all that kind of stuff. But she was kind of from scratch cook, you know. So I mean, we literally went and got live chickens, and she'd dispatch them and pull the feathers and do all the things that it took, and, you know, clean them up and get them ready, and, you know, burn the pin feathers off on the gas on the stove, and,
right,
you know, grow vegetables, buy vegetables. In those years, the vegetable man came around, you know. And women would come out from their houses with their aprons on and or a big basket and get, you know, lima beans and green beans and cabbage, carrots, sweet potatoes, you know, iced potatoes, whatever, you know, eggs, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. It was really the living thing. And was that, and what I'm gonna say was that on the weekend, my father would take my brothers, my sister, and myself out to take my mother out to the country, where there would be these little, you know, photo stands, vegetable right. stands like that. And, you know, she'd stop and buy a bushel of corn, or, you know, quantities of different things, and bring it home and can this stuff and cook things, you know, that real fresh like that. I mean, she was a scratch cook, you know. She right. cooked everything from scratch. So, you know, you don't realize what I did. I just noticed that when I went out to, when we went out and drove out into the country, the pressure of being in the city was totally relieved, and I just loved it. And then we had camp out there. And then eventually by the time I was 16, I was going out pretty much out of the country, being around the dairy farms and doing all that kind of stuff like that. And it was later that, you know, I actually left Santa Monica and moved up to Topanga Canyon. And that's when I wrote that song. I mean, it probably was like I was going to move up to the canyons and take my mailbox food, but I couldn't leave the country that I left out to go and have such a wonderful time. And, you know, land around you, a river that ran for almost a mile alongside the land that was there, you know, and just that kind of life. I've always, you know, liked that, small farms, and, you know, see people that really worked hard for their living, you know, and I appreciated it, and just decided that, you know, the Black Cowboys, you know, the Bluesmen, you know, all these underrepresented people that in my life I was going to represent them, you know.
It's interesting that you moved out to Santa Monica, you know, 1964, and said to play with Ry Cooder. I'm taping this from my house in Santa Monica right now. I wonder where you lived around here. I wonder if you remember.
I lived on.
It was probably pretty different back then.
Yeah. We lived on 21st and Pico. Just about a block from Citadel. You know,
that's literally where we live. That's literally, I'm on 28th and Pico.
Yeah, you're up the other way. You're on the other side of Citadel. Yeah, we were there. And then we were on 4th Street for a while. Wild. Yeah, 4th and Pico. Well, near Pico. Well, yeah. In fact, where it is, I don't know what's in there now, called Linoleum Store or something. But two doors away from me was a place that used to be a club. And I mean, the blues guys used to come and play there.
Oh, really?
I mean, I heard Howlin' Wolf there. And
in Santa Monica.
JD Otto. It's right in the corner of Pico and 21st.
McCabe's Guitar Shop has been there a long time.
Yeah, that's down Pico.
Now, when you've been playing, you know, since obviously the early 60s, especially when you first started touring on those opening records, when you had to go into the South, when you had to go into places that maybe you weren't feeling as welcome, how did that feel?
By the time we were coming to play, we played in lots of different places. We just didn't have hassles. I don't know what it was, whether it was the way we carried ourselves or the places that we played. You know, by the time we got to doing whatever we did, I mean, the Chitlin circuit was a different thing. Those guys were the ones that were ahead of us. And they, you know, by the time we came to there, the civil rights era had gone through and people were, you know, making room for what was next, you know, so we didn't have that. Oftentimes it was other places other than the South that we might have run into something, you know, didn't play enough harmonica for a certain group of motorcycle guys and they could get a little surly, you know, but we're all young and strong and we made a real good, you know, we had a good presence and we had some good guys working with us. So people didn't cross us up. We never got crossed up like that.
It's cool seeing songs again, like filtered through the sands of time. And then, you know, you play Dive and Duck Blues throughout your career, obviously on that 68 self-titled record. And then you team up with Peb Mo on Taj Mo record in 2017. I was able to talk to Keb last year on the show here. And he graciously played some guitar on one of our band's tracks. Such a beautiful soul, you know, just has such a pure joy in his music. What was it like working with him and sort of, you know, keeping those songs sort of in people's consciousness?
It's just what works with us. You know, the first time we ever played it together was on the Crossroads Festival, what Eric Clapton has.
Right.
And that was down in, it was in New York at Madison Square Garden. And the two of us came and played acoustically. And, you know, there was like 30,000 people in there. Two guys get up on stage after everybody's been playing with amplifiers. And, you know, what happens is that kind of intimacy and that kind of direct playing makes everybody, every individual in the audience feel like you're playing right inside of them.
Yeah.
You know? And so people came down there and they're listening to the lyrics. They don't have to try to strain to hear the lyrics over amplification. You know? So yeah, that was the first time we did it.
Well, the sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. You know the sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. Well, now the sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. The wind's gonna rise and blow my blues away. Would you love an arms around me, honey, like this circle around the sun? Put your loving arms around me, baby, like this circle around the sun. Put your loving arms around me, like this circle around the sun. Oh, I'm gonna love you, baby, honey, till my moo cows come home.
That's more like the original way it was done.
Yeah.
By John Estes. You know, but the one that we did in on that first record, I thought the arrangement was really great because I played it with Jesse and then he's the one that came up with that arrangement, you know. And that was one of the great things about him. He was an incredible arranger. I don't think people really know that.
When did you first see, you know, some of the artists like the Rolling Stones, people who are, you know, at the top of the music industry food chain start to reference you and start to sort of want to collaborate with you and your music? When did that start?
Well, I used to work at this club. Well, if you know where the Improv is on Melrose Avenue. Okay. That used to be a great, 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 great blues and roots club called the Ash Grove.
Yeah.
And I, when I first came out to California, and basically one of the first jobs that I had was being the doorman, the bouncer, the seater and greeter, and sometimes the opening act.
Okay.
And oftentimes the Stones, the Animals, and other bands would come in because they actually got to see these players like Lightnin' Hopkins. I mean, like you know, Lightnin' Hopkins was playing one night, and I'm at the door, and I look up, and here comes Johnny Cash. Comes in by himself, no entourage, came in, ordered a drink, sat there, and just enjoyed every note that Lightnin' Hopkins played.
Wow.
You know, and you know, we had a lot of people that came into that club from the movie industry and other industries, but the music industry. But the Stones and those kind of bands like that, Moody Blues, anybody that was playing any kind of blues, they all made it into the different clubs when there were people playing around. So I knew that they knew. And I also knew that something must be going on, because I picked up on them in the 50s when the Skimpole Band would come on. And I would hear them on the radio late at night, you know, going like, and my question was like, wait a second, they're 3,000 miles away from here. Ultimately, like you said, they were at the top of the food chain, basically playing the music that came from here in the States. And they showed up one night at the Whiskey and Go-Go when we had a gig there with Jesse Davis. And I'm playing my harmonica with the band and looking, you know, open my eyes to look down on the floor, and Jagger and Richards and Brian Jones, Bill Wyman,
right.
You know, and the Animals are over here with, Eric Burton and Hilton Valentine. And in the back of the rooms, Eric Clapton and Graham Bond and this Japanese group called the Tigers. And, you know, I just said, hey, by then I'd heard from Ry Cooder, from John Hammond, Bob the Bear Hype from Canned Heat, and Al Wilson from Canned Heat, and Jesse Fuller about what was happening over there in England. And that, you know, you could hear the Howlin' Wolf on the television in the morning. You know, it's like you couldn't hear Howlin' Wolf on television. You're lucky to hear Howlin' Wolf on television now. You know, I mean, relegated to silence, you know. Anyway, so I was really impressed by that. And I just said, you know, let me, and they were doing things, you know, recording when those guys came over. So I came over to introduce myself. And those guys said, hey, wonderful, great show, blah, 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 brilliant. And I just said to them, I said to Mick, I said, hey, I don't know what it is you guys got in the water over there, but you just keep that up. But let me say, if there's anything that you could ever think of having us, you know, do, you know, or you would have any idea that you would like for us to be involved in any of your
projects, right,
just speak up. We're there. And 4 months later, three, 4 months later, they sent us 8 first class round trip tickets from Los Angeles to London on BOAC. And the 4 guys in the band, the 2 road managers, and the management went over, and we had one of the greatest times that, you know, anybody's ever hosted us besides Bonnie Raitt and Princess Caroline from Monaco. You know, I mean, this is pretty serious. And so, you know, all the time I was there, I never stuck my hand in my pocket for anything more than the chewing gum cigarettes that I was smoking at the time, you know, postcards or any gifts that I was going to bring back home. They took care of us in the most royal and comfortable, you know, way. They looked after us and thought a lot of us. And that's why what you see in the rock and roll circus is what happened there, you know.
Got a bird, what a whistle. Baby got a bird, mama got a bird to sing. Baby got a bird, mama got a bird to sing. Without my Corina, sure don't mean, sure don't mean I'm that the thing.
were the only American group that was in that thing. And so Mick was good on his word, man.
Some of my favorite songs of yours are kind of romantic, you know, love songs, you know, Loving in My Baby's Eyes, for example, which you bring back for this live record in Tulsa. You know, you've been in some long relationships, right? I mean, I think you've been married since, what, 1976 or so?
Mm-hmm.
As a person who's only been married for 5 years, what is the advice you would give to me about creating sort of this life where you can keep the romance alive?
keep the romance alive. You know, I mean, be inventive, you know? I mean, just don't take nobody for granted. Take it one day at a time. Sit down and figure out what, you know, look at what you got going, you know? Everything changes and moves, but it's like, there's a lot of things, you know? You just have to pay attention, you know? And also investigate other cultures and how they do things, you know? And, you know, just see what people do, you know? And what you begin to realize that oftentimes is just, you're not aware of these different things to bring to the table, you know? And the other thing is, oftentimes men work hard and they'll play hard, but they don't take the time to have their space to be with their mate, you know. It's real important. You know, create time for it, you know. You know, send the kids to grandma's.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And let them neglect, because they need that grandma or grandpa time, you know, or Uncle Jake, or, you know, Uncle Jake and Aunt Rosie, you know. Send them to camp in the summer, you know, so that they're developing. They're not just up under you.
You know? Was there a person or a moment that brought that song, Loving in My Baby's Eyes, into the world?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really came from my daughter Diva when she was about 2 or 3 years old. She was on the porch, like laying on her back, and I looked down and said, "Hey, how you doing?" And the energy went back and forth between our eyes, and she didn't say much, you know. But I remember that day and that moment. But the song is morphed into you know, more adult fare in it. But right. that was the impetus for that song.
Late at night when I take my rest, oh, I hold your pictures to my chest. Mama, now you know I'd do anything in the world. Loving in my baby's eyes. Give me loving from my baby's eyes. And from my baby's eyes.
I love you, baby. Love you, honey. Mama, now you know I do.
Love you, baby. Love you, darling. Do anything for you.
Newless, I got Tavis Smiley. I was on his show one time. He was saying, "What is this? What do you say about people who say that, you know, the blues is dead?" I said, "Look here, you cannot chew all the flavor out of the blues. It'll never happen." You know, it's just that people who are in control and the gatekeepers say, "Well, that's the old stuff, and we don't listen to that anymore." That's crazy. That's crazy. If it was alive and working for people in you know, 60, 100 years ago, you know, then it's alive and working today. You can hear that it comes from that, but see, there's no, if they keep gatekeeping it and keeping it down, then the sound that everybody hears that's happening, that they're trying to sell, is the sound that they think it is. Like, I'm sorry, you know, the rap and hip hop today is not just, you know, it's not the only thing that's, you know, Black American culture, you know. Mm. I mean, it went from the dominant Americans deciding that it wasn't music to, you know, you hear it on hearing it come back when it's on Fox News. So now what?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? This is the stuff you didn't like, you know?
Yeah. Well, the counterculture becomes the mainstream.
Yeah.
And then it like kind of goes in this weird cycle where the music that was the music of rebellion becomes the music you put to sell trucks and Coca-Cola, yeah, you know, 10 years later.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Right.
Well, it's funny because you could even hear Howlin' Wolf, like Smokestack Lightning, selling Viagra.
Yeah, exactly. And John Lee Hooker, both of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trucks and Viagra. Yeah, right. You know.
Has anyone approached you to put your music into a bizarre place commercially?
No. Well, maybe a long time ago we did a commercial for something called A Smile Jeans, and that was it. Man, that was back. What was that back? Maybe in the 70s, but that's it. You know. I think somebody used Ain't Nobody's Business But My Own, the Masson. One of the wineries is champagne. Don't drive me crazy. Don't make me lazy. Ain't nobody's business but my own. You know, they use that, you know, as a, you know, a little come on there, but no, not really. There's not a whole bunch of, they don't seem to, you know, I mean, I guess they're looking for something else. It's too organic or whatever. I don't know, but I'm not hanging around waiting for them.
I know one of your favorite records you did in 1999 with the Kora Master for Mali, Tumani Diabate, a record called Kulanjan,
yeah.
Yeah. Have you actually toured in Africa at all? Have you gone to Mali and played any?
No, I haven't been to Mali, but in 79, we toured 13 different countries. And then we went again in early 2000s. To Zanzibar. We made another record there, really nice, called Mukutano. And yeah, you know, go back, touch base over there all the time.
The long crested hunting hawk eagle, the master hunter.
Do you feel like you're maybe a modern version of that griot tradition?
Griot, yeah. Yeah, American griot.
Because, you know, storytellers from all walks of life are so needed, you know, throughout time and history as the people who can actually maybe pull back the curtain about what's really going on in our culture. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're not appreciated in their own time. But when you have the privilege of being around in the culture for 70 years making music, you've seen the evolution of American culture, music. And, you know, you have so much more to say than most people, especially my age. And, you know, I'm grateful that you're here making music for people to hear now and preserving a lot of the music that I love for a new generation. I think that's super important.
Well, I've been lucky because sometimes it's like three or even four generations. You know, the grandparents,
right,
are like in their 80s and they had their kids young, you know, and then, you know, so now it's the great grandbabies. But the thing is that what I wanted to do was hook my music up to that, which was an older tradition, which had been unbroken by, you know, commercial intervention. You know, it's been passed for, like with Tumani. Tumani's 71st generation.
Mm.
You know, it's like, what can you see here? You know, that's 71 generations. You know, if you have to tell somebody about you know, I mean, they, with the way they're set up, they're not using their facility to maintain and keep connected to the great consciousness.
Last thing I'll ask you is if you could have studio time with one band or one artist, dead or alive, you could get them in the room with you and make a new album, who would it be? Anyone throughout history?
Good question. I'd probably like to play with the either the International Rhythm Band that I had back in the 70s, or the Intergalactic Soul Messengers Band from there, and the Hula Blues Band. It's really crazy. It's really crazy because when I start saying that, then I think of the great music that I made with Jesse Davis, you know, Tuba Band. I mean, all of those things are really monumental movements that, you know, it always shocked me how people couldn't hear it.
You know? Well, there's still time. They can hear it now.
Oh yeah, no. I let that stuff go years ago. I just stop worrying about whether they hear it or not. Get the work done. That's the most important thing. At this point, I am not sitting here talking about woulda, coulda, shoulda. You know, if you see somebody like Salvador Dali and you go like, this guy was from nuts. I mean, him, Picasso, Le Chevalier de Saint-Georges, Joseph Bologna, him, you know, Ravel. I mean, Ravel's Bolero. Miles Davis, you know, anywhere Miles. But, you know, I mean, Kind of Blue. You know, I like it on vinyl. I don't like it on any other. Sounds the warmest on vinyl. I'm always listening to vinyl. I never gave my vinyl up. I didn't care.
That's what it was, you know, in that little closet next to my bed in Chicago, my dad's record collection, that's where he kept it. And I started wandering in there. And one of the first couple records I saw was King of the Delta Blues, Robert Johnson.
Great record.
Steely Dan's like greatest hits or something. And then that Taj Mahal self-titled record, you know, in front of that house.
Yeah.
And that leave-in trunk harmonica, man, it just bursts out of the speakers, you know, like almost sounds like it's going to break the speakers, you know.
Yeah, it'll definitely open up, you know, the front of your brain.
Well, I appreciate you doing your thing, and I hope to see you out on the road soon. You know, better keep touring till you're 100.
That's what I'm trying to do.
All right, man. We'll keep up the good work.
You're welcome.
All right.
I will.
There he goes. Taj Mahal, everybody. Thanks to his team and for Taj jumping on and being so gracious with his time. Season 6, we're here. We're doing it. Swinging Live at the Church in Tulsa is his new record on Lightning Rod Records. And you can check him out at TajBlues.com. I think he's in maybe Australia right now. He'll be coming here to L.A. Playing Mavis Staples' 85th All-Star Birthday Concert on April 18th. I hope I get a ticket to that. And he'll be at Rochester International Jazz Fest in June. Lots of stuff to come. TajBlues.com. The dude has been touring for like 60 years. My group, Dust Bowl Revival, we've been doing it for like 10 years. And we're going to be back in April playing in New England, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. and going to Nashville, North Carolina, Atlanta, some cool stuff in May, and then playing June 1st back in L.A. at McCabe's Guitar Shop just down the street. Going back to our roots, please check it out, DustBowlRevival.com. And every Saturday, you can hear me at 7 a.m. on 88.5 The SoCal Sound here in L.A. But enough about me. If you have an artist or a songwriter that I should talk to on our new season, send me a line on our Instagram, Show on the Road Podcast, and we have some cool episodes coming at you. Peter One, the amazing artist from South Africa, will have a talk with amazing New York orchestral band San Fermin, and many more. Check it out, theshowontheroad.com/episodes, and we'll see you in a couple weeks with more episodes. As always, The Show on the Road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Z. Lupitin, and we are part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Stay safe, stay creative, and we'll see you on the trail.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.